You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. At the new year in Ireland, on the hunt for legendary heroes, bloodthirsty vampires and the Fae, in the company of the wonderful Morgan Daimler. Morgan's prolific and consistently outstanding quality of work allows us to learn so much about forgotten history and folklore from across Ireland. Morgan and I hunt down the history of Lu, the many-skilled god. A hero who leads the oppressed to victory, Lu is a hero who many may not have heard of. Morgan also introduces us to two vampires, both with very particular tastes and histories, amongst other fascinating aspects of Irish myth and legend. Morgan's first appearance back on episode 88 was incredibly popular, so I know this conversation will be just as much. But before that, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon for $4 a month to get ad-free episodes, early access, bonus content and more. Click on the links in the show notes or go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find us at mysteriesandmonsters.com, where you can also get hold of your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise by clicking the links at the top of the page. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel, my brother, for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, to Ireland we go, on the hunt for monsters, magic and vampires, in the company of Morgan Daimler. On this week's show, we make a long overdue return to the topic of the Fae. And who better to educate us on this subject than Morgan Daimler? Morgan is the author of more than 24 books on subjects relating to Irish mythology, paganism and the Fae. She has contributed to multiple anthologies and magazines and taught workshops covering these fascinating topics across the USA and beyond. Morgan's first appearance back on episode 88 was wildly popular, so I am delighted to once again welcome her back to Mysteries and Monsters. Morgan, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be back.
I'm delighted to have you back. As I touched on in the introduction there, it was a wonderfully successful episode. I've had people ever since you've been on saying, when's Morgan coming back? Can we talk about this bit? You've not covered that. Your pronunciation wasn't that bad, Paul. Those kind of things, Morgan, as I'm sure you're often to do. But the first question I want to ask, since we've not spoken for 15 months, is...
I know. It's hard to believe.
It is, I know. As we were laughing before we started, it's the longest, shortest 12 months ever, I think.
It really is. It defies space and time, which is very fairy thing.
Absolutely. I think we are all in the wormhole.
Definitely.
So, when we first spoke, you blew my mind with the fact that you had decided to take on the endeavour of learning Old Irish. So, how's that been going?
Good. You know, there's actually a surprising amount of resources out there. I mean, obviously, if I could go to university for it, I would, but it's not an option for me. So, you know, there's a lot you can find online and there's a lot of things that you can purchase, particularly books and workbooks. So I've definitely been keeping up with that. I just had a new book of translations that I've done that I put out. I like to do it every day a little bit to keep getting better at it, hopefully.
Absolutely. I mean, that was very impressive to see that you'd actually started to release publications doing translations, Morgan. So is that, I know when we spoke last time, that seemed to be one of the key aspects of your reasoning for wanting to learn this, because a lot of the texts are in this olden language.
Yes. I often say that spite is my main reason for learning it. Yeah. a lot of the translations that we have available are 100 years old or more. And the translators at the time, there's a lot of issues with the way they approached things. You know, if they felt material was too inappropriate for the audience, shall we say, they would just not include it. And they would also add their own material as they thought it was helpful, which, you know, I can see the logic that they took with it. But what you get then is a story that isn't actually what the original story says. You know, it's something else. And so that when I first realized that, I got kind of angry about it. It's a great motivator. And yeah, I decided I would just learn to read it myself so that I could go and see what it actually said.
Do you think that working on the translations and bringing them up to date and releasing them to the public that have a deep fascination in these subjects, Morgan, do you think that's both challenging and educational for you, that you're both learning about these legends that you love so much and these myths and stories, as well as the fact that it seems also to be an aspect of this that seems to have been overlooked for quite a long time?
Yeah, definitely. You know, and there's, it's like anything else, particularly the folklore, you know, it evolves with time. So there are different versions. There are versions that are out today that, you know, have changed from what we had historically. But to me, it's really fascinating to go back and look at what we find in the oldest material and kind of what that can tell us about how some of these things were viewed or were understood. You know, like the leprechaun is a great example. You know, when a lot of people, you picture that today, we have this very, I'll say, particular image of what, you know, of what a leprechaun would be and sort of what they do. And, you know, this idea of them as a shoemaker and they hide gold. And if you catch them, you know, you can try to make them reveal it, but they're very tricky. So that often doesn't work. But when we look in the older Irish material, there's two stories. They go back about 1,000 years that they think are the oldest references to leprechauns. And they're very, very different. They're actually these sort of water sprites, water spirits. And there's a whole society. They have a king and a queen, and there's bards and, you know, common folk leprechauns. And, you know, they basically live in a world that would have been parallel to what the human world was like at the time. So no mention of shoemakers specifically. And, you know, we see the character Fergus, because this is the Adventures of Fergus and the Death of Fergus are the two stories that talk about them. When he first encounters them, he falls asleep kind of by the shore of this lake, and three of these leprechauns, three of these water spirits come out and try to drag him into the lake to drown him. And not exactly the image that we have of leprechauns today. And, you know, he ends up waking up and then he fights with them. And of course, it's an Irish epic. So it's this very dramatic tale.
Yes.
And he ends up subduing them, and then they give him basically one wish, because obviously they're magical beings, and he wants to be able to breathe underwater. So that's sort of what they grant him for their freedom. So there's shades of that that are similar to what we find in like the modern stories. But to me, being able to go back and look at the original and kind of see what people thought about this subject, what people believed about these beings 1,000 years ago, it's just so fascinating.
Is it easy or hard then, Morgan, to kind of pinpoint when the genesis of the modern interpretation of what a leprechaun is then? Because obviously, as you've just described there, that bears no resemblance really to what, if you said to anybody, you know, depending on how many bad horror films people have watched, perhaps. I know after we last spoke, I ended up watching three of the more recent entries into the leprechaun horror film genre, all of varying qualities, though one of them was particularly dreadful. primarily because it was one of those films where nobody in it seemed to be actually Irish.
Yeah.
And everybody was attempting really bad Irish accents, apart from the tourists who were caught there, as you may find, and also that the leprechaun seemed to have become the predator, if for some reason. So is there a point in oral history or written history where you've been able to kind of look at it and go, ah, so that's when it's changed from its origin story, really?
Sure. laughing about the movies now to myself. Yeah, some of them are so bad that they're almost good because they're horrifically bad. Yeah. Interestingly, I think Irish Americans can kind of be blamed for some of this. The oldest written reference to what we would consider like the modern version of the leprechaun is from, I believe it's the 1840s, 1848, if I remember correctly. And it was an Irish American author writing in the United States who was talking about this shoemaker and, you know, sort of this more kind of a children's version of a leprechaun. Mm. Of course, we do find those ideas in Ireland as well. If you look on Duishes.ie, which is a site from Dublin University that recorded folklore and stories from the 1920s and 1930s in Ireland, you will see references to, you know, leprechauns there as the solitary shoemaker and that sort of thing. So is it possible that it was in Ireland before it was written down in the United States? It's possible. But is it possible that it was written down in that particular work and then it kind of spread from there? I mean, we've seen things like that happen before. So, you know, it's possible that that's where the sort of modern idea came from. And then it got popular and spread.
Hmm.
Which is what happens with these things. So
it is interesting when I've looked into this subject so much since we spoke, because it's really opened my eyes to a whole world of, as I mentioned when we originally spoke, of things I was aware of but didn't really know that much about, Morgan.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
I've started to see real variations in different legends and stories, and it's very interesting to see that there seems to be two or three different versions. It depends on whoever decided to write up the story, as we were referring to about sort of censoring them and removing aspects of the story that may have been unpalatable, often that they didn't seem to fit with Christian teachings, because a lot of these seem to have been written up by Christians when Christianity arrived in Ireland. And it seems that there seems, as with anything, it's not just Christianity, it can apply to any kind of civilization, I think. When you have an overriding change in direction or religion, often they will try and incorporate or adapt these stories for their audience rather than the actual source material.
Yeah, no, and that's, it's actually a really interesting open debate among scholars of Irish mythology and folklore about how much of the older written material is genuinely older Irish material and how much of it was kind of influenced, like you were just saying, by these outside sources, the scribes and the monks wanting to make their material seem more similar to things that were well known at the time.
Mm.
And you'll get a variety of opinions on this, on, you know, some people feel that there's a lot of genuine material in it. Some people feel that there is not. So it kind of varies. But I will say that the original source material, what we have in writing, in the oldest material, it is pretty bawdy. I guess that's the polite way to say it. I think the monks got quite a kick out of recording some of it. Now, Is some of that, you know, was that supposed to be sort of propaganda against it because they depict it in this sort of very times almost kind of vulgar sort of way? Is that how it actually originally was? Because some of it is extremely entertaining. You know, it's hard to say, but definitely once we hit that Victorian era with the translators, they started censoring stuff left, right, and center. they were not into bawdy.
Yeah, it is interesting how you look at it. You can kind of think, oh well, perhaps they were disgusted by it and wanted to try and censor it. But also, I think that's a very good point, that by republishing these stories, they were basically saying, God, look at this, isn't it disgusting? That's why you need to be with us.
Yeah, it definitely goes both ways. And you know, I think people also kind of forget when we're talking about, again, some of this older material, like say the Ulster Cycle, you know, we look at it today almost as like great literature.
Yes.
You know, it's preserved as this in this sort of very esteemed way. But at the time when it was being told orally or when it was first written down, it was kind of the equivalent of like a soap opera or like an action adventure movie, you know, and it's very, very over the top and very action packed and again, very bawdy in a lot of cases. You know, it would have been the sort of thing that if you were the audience, it would have been very captivating.
Yes.
You know, as opposed to this, the way we treat it today, where it's like very dry and very respectable. Like, well, not so much originally.
Well, I think that kind of sets up the first character I wish to speak about, because when we're talking about epics and action-packed stories, Lurg seems to be larger than life. I was one of those, I'd heard his name mentioned in passing before, and then obviously I thirstily looked for your latest releases, and I was delighted to see that this was one of your recent publications, Morgan. Mm-hmm. What a story this is. I mean, there are a lot of things that I think you can look at all kinds of mythologies from around the world, and there are epics on a similar scale to this. And I think often when we look at Celtic and Irish folklore, it's things like this that seem to have been really overlooked, because this story of Lurg and his life and the people he worked with and the battles and the people he's fighting and the creatures and magic that's involved, it is a phenomenal epic story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really is. And Lurg in general, like, that, he does get a lot of attention comparatively in the Irish pantheon. But overall, more generally, I don't think enough people really appreciate him.
Mm.
He has a lot of just fascinating things that go on, you know, and he appears in pretty much all of the really significant mythology, I think. He even shows up in the Ulster cycle because he's supposed to be Hugh Cullen's father.
Mm.
Although that's a whole very complicated thing right there. You know, but we have him there. We have him kind of across the scope of things, and going back to the oldest recorded material, even into like the 16th, 17th century, there's still stories that were being recorded at that point that kind of feature him. So it just speaks like how important he was. And he's definitely feisty. He has some anger management issues. So when he shows up, he definitely makes things more action-packed and interesting in most of the stories.
Yeah, I find it very interesting as well, because it's there's a real interesting aspect of his beginnings, really, where he's almost like a savior that arrives to kind of lead this population. Is it the Tuatha De Danann?
The Tuatha De Danann, yep.
And basically, these people are very oppressed and they seem to be very downtrodden. And Lurg just goes, no, I don't think this is on. I can save you all. So for anybody that doesn't know much about this chap and his story, could you kind of tell us what leads into this point and what he then does as part of this new civilization that he's come to protect?
Sure. So there's two main versions of this, but I'm going to go with the older one because I like that one better. So, and this would be in the Cath Mhoi Tuatha, the Battle of the Plain of Pillars. And basically, Lu is the child of one of the two of the Danann, Cian, who is the son of Dian Ket, who's like the healer god of the two of the Danann, and a Fomorian woman. And that right there is sort of setting the stage for some things, because the Fomorians are these sort of chthonic beings in Irish mythology. We never find out where they came from originally. Mm. They just sort of show up, you know, whereas all the other people, groups of people in Irish mythology, we kind of get a backstory for them. Like, this is where they're from and this is where they went and all that. But not with the Fomorians. They just sort of are there and tending to cause problems for multiple different groups. And when the Tuatha De Danann first arrive in Ireland, there's a group called the Fir Bolg there, and there's a big fight and they drive them out, and then the Tuatha De Danann sort of take over and are ruling Ireland. But the king of the Tuatha De Danann in that fight loses his arm. And they have a law that says you can't rule as king unless you are physically whole.
Mm.
So he kind of gets ousted. And the person they choose to replace him is someone whose father is Fomorian and whose mother is Tuatha De Danann. So sort of the inverse of Lu.
Mm.
And his name is Bresh. And Bresh is very physically beautiful, but he's not exactly the greatest king. And he ends up letting his father's people sort of put the Tuatha De Danann under this oppression. They're taxed horribly, you know, and Bresh has sort of the major heroes of the Tuatha De Danann doing all this menial labor, building him a fort and collecting firewood and things like that. And so they're all pretty unhappy and miserable with him as king. And eventually they decide they're going to rebel, but they really don't take a lot of action except for telling him they don't like him as king. And then Lu sort of comes into the picture, and he had been sort of kept separate for a lot of this. And he shows up, and in order to get entrance into like the High King's presence, which at this point is the original one who had been wounded and kind of taken back over when Bresh leaves, he is told he can't enter unless he has a skill that no one else has. So he goes through this whole list of skills, and it's kind of everything you could possibly want. You know, are you a blacksmith? Are you a warrior? Are you a cupbearer? Are you a magician? Are you, you know, all these different things.
Mm.
But every time he says something, the doorkeeper's like, well, we already have one of those. We already have one of those, you know.
Yeah.
sort of, we don't need you here. And so finally, at the very end, Lu is like, well, do you have any one person who can do all of that? And they don't, of course, which is how he gets his one of his names is the many skilled, Lu the many skilled. So I sort of let him in, and he challenges the greatest of their champions to a test of arms and wins. And he plays Fidcho, which is kind of like chess, and beats everyone. And so the king, Nuatha, is sort of like, I think that we have the best chance of winning if Lu is the one who's leading us. And so he steps down and lets Lu step in and lead them. And he does eventually become the High King. And, you know, he kind of goes forward, and he's the one who's inspiring everyone to fight. He's the one who sort of prepares for the battle. And then as they're getting into the actual battle itself beforehand, because he is also a magician, he has this whole big scene where he's like putting a curse on the enemy army. His grandfather is one of the major like dangers in the Fomorian. He has a poisonous eye that anyone he looks on, you're kind of done.
Yeah.
And it's been prophesied that Lu is the only one who can kill him. So they end up having this big, you know, final movie style confrontation in the battle. And of course, Lu does what the prophecy had said he was would do and does kill him. And, you know, he just sort of proves himself to be this kind of ultimate figure, this ultimate king. He's good at everything. He's a great warrior. He's a great leader. He does, like I said, have some anger issues going on. He's very quick-tempered.
Yes.
I think is the way they refer to it. But he's sort of this epic hero who comes in and inspires the Tuatha De Danann and leads them to victory, sort of when it was not looking particularly good for them up to that point.
Yeah, I know this battle is quite remarkable because, as you refer to, this opponent has this evil eye that apparently poisons people or kills them or however it sort of enraptures people to victory for them. And I believe Lu is one of his men. As we said, he's a many skilled man, and he's an expert slingshot. And he kind of, I mean, I was reading it and I was like, blimey, that's a bit intense. Because he basically forces his eye out of the back of his head, and that infects the army that they're fighting, doesn't it?
Yep, it does. And then it's some ridiculous amount of the Fomorian warriors are like laid low immediately because of this poisonous eye. He has two main weapons. He has a spear, which is one of like the four treasures of the Suatha Danann and of the Irish gods. But he also, yes, is very skilled with the slingshot and sort of uses that in this case to overcome Balor. So it's interesting imagery.
Yes, very much so. And he's also one of those heroes that seems to have an affinity with animals as well, because he has a sort of greyhound whippet by his side for most of this epic as well, doesn't he?
He does. He has a dog that's particularly associated with him. In some stories, he's also connected to like crows and ravens. Not the way we would say with like, you know, the Morrigan or who can take that form, but has this connection. He is connected to a horse. It's originally said to be Manannan MacLir's horse, but it's often referred to as Lewis as well. Manannan MacLir being Lewis' foster father. So when Lewis goes into battle, he has a lot of things that Manannan gave him, including this horse. Magical horse, of course, can run over the top of the water, runs faster than the wind, all of that exciting stuff you would expect with a magical horse. And yeah, there's actually a piece of artwork that was just done in Ireland. It's a mural on the side of a building. I think it's a hotel. But it depicts Lou with the dog. Fall Inish, I think, is its name, the dog's name.
And he also, despite being this wonderfully brave, strong and clever warrior, there are some aspects that, once again, you can look at other myths that, as with anything, these great heroes unfortunately come to an untimely end. And it seems that for Lou, it's down to, does his wife get killed and he then loses his temper, kills somebody else, and then the sons of this person he's killed decide to right these wrongs, Morgan?
It's slightly bawdier than that. So Lou has four wives in the mythology, and one of his wives in particular ends up having an affair and sleeping with a god named Kermit. And Lou, I mentioned the anger issues, does not take this well. And he ends up killing Kermit. And that doesn't last for long, because Kermit is the son of the Dagda, who is another of the major gods of the Tuatha Dé Danann. And Dagda finds a way to revive him, bring him back to life. But Kermit's three sons do not take well to their father being killed, even temporarily. And yes, they do eventually chase Lou down and end up killing him. There's actually a location in Ireland that's named for the grave of Lou that people are, if you can find it, you'd be able to visit it. So, a lot of these stories are very tied into the landscape. But yeah, it's common in the Irish mythology to see that sort of a thing. So Lou, for example, his father, Cian, according to a different story, is killed by three sons of someone else. And Lou then kind of arranges the death of those three. So there's sort of a continuity, I guess you would say, in the fact that, you know, his father is killed by these three brothers, the sons of Turin. And then Lou himself later is killed by these three brothers, the sons of Kermit. So there's some interesting parallels, at least, going on with that.
Yeah, and it's a very strange death, because I think one of the sources I read was that they stab him in the foot and then they drown him. And it, once again, as we were talking about the birth of the leprechaun legend, Morgan, there seems to be a real thing about people being drowned as a form of death.
Yeah.
Alongside being stabbed in the foot, which you could kind of say, well, it's very similar to Achilles, that, you know, it's his lower limbs that seem to be his weak point. And I found that very odd, once again, as you refer to there about these parallels between three brothers or three sons often turning up throughout these different stories, as though, once again, you have this symbolism of three for whatever reason.
Yep, there are some versions of the birth of Lou, which, again, this is one of those things across folk belief and mythology, there's multiple versions of the story, but there's some versions of that story where Lu was actually one of three children. He was a triplet.
Mm.
And the other two were either killed or cast into the ocean, and he was the one who survived. So, you know, again, we see that idea with the three brothers.
Yeah.
Three children. So definitely very interesting layers there. And there have been people who have compared his fight with Balor, his fight with his grandfather, to sort of the biblical David and Goliath. I think mostly because of the sling.
Yes.
But it's certainly an interesting thing to consider, the similarities and the layers in the story.
Mm. There does seem to be a lot of that goes on where they try and compare myths from certain countries, Morgan, with different ones. And I've seen people try and also say this runs parallel with the North myth of Loki killing Baldur.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar. And I've often wondered, do you think that that's just a train of thought where people are saying, well, these stories are all very similar, as if they're trying to say, oh, well, they've obviously copied them from each other? Or do you think that that's another interesting aspect, that's a very simple way of trying to explain these similar kind of stories?
Yeah, I think it's human nature to see the patterns and the similarities between things.
Mm.
I don't know myself that we would ever know for certain if it was a matter of cross-cultural contamination, if mm-hmm. you will, because obviously there was a lot of contact between a lot of these cultures, or if it's just there's something about that story that is sort of universal to the human psyche.
Mm.
You know, there's something about it that we all kind of like the idea of, you know, the synchronicity, the continuity, the idea that, you know, it starts in a way and it kind of ends the same way it starts on some level. And the idea of sort of the underdog coming out on top against the, you know, the big bad guy.
Yeah.
There's so many layers to that I think we can find across a lot of different stories around the globe, because it's just something that speaks to humanity. But how much of that is what's going on, and how much is that the Irish and the Norse had a lot of contact with each other? I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose it's trying to find out the earliest source, really. And that, unfortunately, I would suggest is probably lost to the mists of time, because it would be very interesting to kind of see when either of these two stories sort of appeared in their respective communities, Morgan. Because, like I say, if one leads the other, I think often the more well-known one is often sort of put forward as the explanation for why the other one's there. Whereas if we had the historical record, we could probably say, well, actually, Lu came first, not Loki.
Right. And unfortunately, I think for what we have in writing, the timing is really similar.
Mm.
Because Loki, we'd be looking, I believe it's Snorri Sturluson, and that's right around 1,000 years ago. And then Lu, it's the same, you know, the material we'd be looking at is right around 1,000 years ago. So that does not help us solve this problem. And like I said, both of the cultures had contact with each other. So it's hard to say if there was influence going on, who was influencing who.
Yeah. Yeah. As always, another mythological conundrum for us, Morgan.
Yes. I actually like questions that don't have easy answers, because it really gives you something to think about.
Yeah, very true. And I think often when you get past the simplistic explanations, I find that the fact that there isn't an easy answer is far more satisfying often.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't trust easy answers. Anytime there's an easy answer, I'm suspicious. And then you dig in, and then there's usually a difficult answer underneath.
Well, you'll hopefully like my next subject. Now, this is another one, and I think what I've noticed about this is, as a lover of Dracula, and as we approach the anniversary, Morgan, I think it's 125 years in 2022 that Stoker's novel appeared and terrified people across the world. I've found it very interesting recently that often people have always kind of put forward that Stoker was influenced by Vlad Tepes, despite the fact that seems to be somebody making a massive leap of faith and saying, oh, well, they're very similar, and obviously one's called Dracula, so it must be the same thing. But I was very interested to see that someone else has started to kind of say that actually we think that Stoker's influence falls using two Irish vampires, which I'd heard of but didn't know that much about. So that the first one is a fabulous story, and as we've touched on, there seems to be about three different versions of this lady's story. So hopefully
it's always at least three.
Once again, and three is the magic number, it seems.
It is.
So this one is a fascinating story, and also seems to be one that's been around for a very, very long time. And that's the story of this poor lady that ends up becoming the Daragdu.
Yeah, the Daragdu is a really, really fascinating, fascinating concept, I think.
Mm.
I could see how that could have influenced some of what Stoker wrote. Not Dracula as a character specifically, but some of the other things that were going on in that book as well, like the Brides of Dracula, and even some of the storyline with Lucy, I think. So I'm getting like very literary analytical here.
That's all right.
Yeah, the Daragdu, it's a story, again, as you mentioned, there's multiple versions, but my favorite version anyway is it was a young woman who did not want to marry the person her father had picked out for her, because he sort of had a reputation for being a very cruel person. She was in love with someone else. She wanted to marry him. She was forced to marry the person her father had chosen anyway, which, you know, realistically is what happened across a wide stretch of history. And does not survive long into the marriage. And the version of the story, again, that I'm particularly familiar with, that I like, she ends up sort of casting herself off of a height, saying that she, you know, would rather do herself in than be stuck with such a cruel, horrible man.
Mm.
And because of how everything happens, when she's buried, she does not stay buried. And again, this is more of the particularly local folklore. Once a year, she would return from the grave. And, you know, we sort of have that classic blood drinking thing going on.
Mm.
And in local folklore is the idea that they would put stones on her grave to keep it so that she couldn't return. But it sort of has all of the things in a tragic story that you want. You know, this poor young girl who is in love and can't be with the person she loves and ends up with this cruel person and, you know, just can't abide it. But then even death sort of can't keep her down. No pun intended. You know, and then she keeps coming back to try to get revenge in a way on the people who put her in that situation. So anyway, that's my favorite version of the story. Again, there are others that are out there.
Yeah, yeah, because there are. I've seen three different versions of how she dies, Morgan. Yeah. As you say, there's one where she throws herself, there's one where she poisons herself, and there's one where she starves herself.
Yeah.
But I have to say the thing I love about this story is it's a very interesting interpretation of what we would consider the vampire mythos for me.
Yeah.
Because often vampires are created usually by the unfortunate incident of meeting another one. And often that's how you become a vampire, depending on certain cultures, obviously. In China, it's if you could be cursed, if you're buried the wrong way, those type of things. Whereas the European tradition, more often than not, is you become a vampire because you've met another one at some point.
Self-perpetuating vampires.
Absolutely. As I suppose, a metaphor for infection and plague, which is rather ironic in this day and age. But this story.
Sorry. That was a horrible 2020-2021 joke, but that was hilarious.
Oh, thank you very much. You can come again, Morgan. but this seems to be one of the first instances I can see where it's revenge and anger that basically creates this situation. And I also, I mean, the way she comes back and what she does, because Her name, I think, means two different things as well, doesn't it? And one of them, I think, is it Red Thirst?
That's one of the translations that you'll see kind of floating around, yeah.
Mm. And I just love it, that the fact that she's so wronged that she's been taken from the man who loves her, and she knows that this person she's been married to is in such a position that the love of her life cannot possibly save her, which is incredibly sad as well, because he's just a local farmhand or a peasant, I believe, Morgan, I think, in most of those versions. But by God, she gets revenge. And I love the fact that she goes after her dad first.
Yeah. Yep. She goes after the people who put her in that position. Yeah. It's actually not, I wouldn't say an inspiring story, but it has some aspects of that. You know, it definitely, you can sympathize with her and sort of understand her motivation up until, of course, she runs out of people that wronged her. And then, you know, she's still coming back and going after people. Then it's a little less sympathetic. But
when I was looking into this, as I was said, because there are so many different versions of it, it's very interesting when you see these different interpretations, Morgan. I've seen versions that clearly have a Christian slant, because they're saying the reason she came back was that she repented God. I've only seen that in a couple of them. The majority of them, there's no mention of Christianity whatsoever. So that's, as we touched on earlier, a very interesting tenet of some of these stories. It depends which version and who wrote it that you find. But I also was very taken by one, and I don't know if you could shed any light on this, that we have a real aspect of the vampire legend that in a few of the versions I've seen, she just goes after her dad and kills him. But I've seen in a couple of them that her dad has to invite her into his house in the first instance, which is obviously, you know, a cliche of vampires, that they can't get you unless you invite them in. And I found that quite odd. Would you say that this is one of those things that seems to have been added after vampires have become more popular? Or is it something that kind of predates in your sort of understanding, or perhaps that you've uncovered?
And here's an interesting thing with this, because I would tend to say that that's probably a later addition to the folklore as sort of the more widespread vampire material came in. However, I will also note that in sort of wider fairy lore, it's not uncommon to see stories where the good folk can't enter a home unless they're either invited in, or some sort of protection that would normally be there is not done properly or is forgotten.
Mm.
So the idea that he would have to invite her in or let her in, it definitely, of course, is in line with the later vampire folklore, but it's not entirely out of bounds for Irish, native Irish folklore either. So it could go either way.
That's once again a more interesting answer than I suspected I was planning to hear. One of the other aspects, as you touched on there, that obviously when this lady sets off, she deals with everybody that she needs to deal with.
Yeah.
But obviously she's a vampire, so she's thirsty.
Yep.
And I found it very interesting that there seemed to be this kind of situation where she'll kill some people and others she'll just take enough to keep her thirst abated, which is one of those things that I've never really seen in a vampire story before, because usually when a vampire's on the run out for food, everybody's fair game.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the few situations where there seems to be some kind of lack of murderous intent for some reason in certain aspects of it.
Yeah, I definitely think that reflects kind of the layers with the story, and also that she is a very sympathetic sort of being. You know, it's not like some of the other stories that we have of dangerous beings or dangerous creatures where, you know, they're doing it because they delight in it. You know, like, say, Scottish red caps, for example, you know, they kill people, but they do it because it entertains them, apparently, or, you know, they enjoy it. They dye their hats in human blood and all that.
Yeah.
With the Jerigdu, it seems like she is doing it because she has to do it. And because of her backstory, because of this idea that, you know, she was sort of put in this untenable position, which led her to become what she is. She has a much more sympathetic character, I think. And yeah, there's definitely the versions where, you know, she'll attack people, but she doesn't kill everyone or every time. And then, of course, there are the others where you definitely don't want to run across her at night.
I mean, how far back does this story go, Morgan, as well? Because I think that's another interesting aspect of it, because often we can look at these stories and think, oh, well, they've only got popular in the last 150 years since vampires made their sort of literary debut in the West. This story, from what I can gather, certainly goes back centuries, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does predate Stoker, as far as I'm aware. I do think it's one of those ones that it's a little hard to pinpoint exactly how old it might be, because we don't start seeing it in writing as much until we start to see the folklore collections being done.
Yeah,
which is not uncommon. There's, you know, there's a lot of material that wasn't recorded until, say, you know, at some point in the late 19th into the 20th century, or even the late 18th century. But we know that they're much older beliefs. You know, we know that they're much older stories. We just don't know how old. You know, for example, we have the Ballad of Tam Lin. Again, this Scottish. But in writing, like, the oldest version, I believe, goes back to the 17th century. But we know that it existed before that. It was written down at that point because it was a very popular ballad. But we have no idea how old it is. You know, there's no reference to when it originally sort of was created or was performed, because it was oral. And, you know, once we get into the oral material, it gets very difficult sometimes to know exactly how old concepts are.
Yeah, I must admit, I was recently watching, because I know that's one of your most recent videos you've done on your YouTube channel, Morgan, about the Ballad of Manten. And so things like that I always find really fascinating, because, as you say, it's very interesting to note that these stories are so popular, more often than not, that's the reason they get written down by people, because they want to make some money out of it.
Yeah. You know, the ballads, to digress slightly just for a moment, the ballad material like Tam Lin is really fascinating to look at from a folklore perspective, because it goes back for so long. It's anchored in a physical location. And there's still stories about that location today. But, you know, we have the older ballad versions. We have modern books. We have modern songs. We have just a sort of plethora of material that all is rooted back in that, because there's something about the concept of it. You know, there's something about that story of a girl who falls in love with a fairy knight who was originally human, and then sort of sets about to rescue him from the queen of the fairies, that just really resonates with people. You know, it's, people can't stop retelling this.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of these stories that focus on love and loss. And as we're saying about the Duragdu, I find it quite a mature story, Morgan, as you say, because often these kind of, especially in the era that this story had to go through, when you think of the way women in certain communities were treated, dealing with witchcraft and, you know, strange women living in the woods and being sort of a target for scorn and being picked upon for no other reason than keeping out the way of people more often than not. I'm very interested that some of these stories seem to be able to survive that kind of era and that kind of perception of the women in the community and still make it through the other side essentially intact in its original form.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of that is because the story with her is something that speaks to people on a sort of universal level. Everyone, not everyone necessarily is, you know, forced into a marriage they don't want and loses the person they truly love necessarily. But there's something about that idea, I think, that everyone can kind of relate to. Being forced into something that you don't want to do and losing someone that you love one way or another. There's something about it that just speaks to people. And again, I think that's why we see the different versions of the story, the way that it sort of persisted across the centuries. It's tragic, but there's also that sort of aspect where she does get her revenge. which I think people appreciate, even if it's sort of scary and you don't necessarily want to meet her at night. It's also kind of reassuring to know that the people who put her in that position were punished for it.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. And unlike Lou, her grave is still there. It's in a graveyard, and as you refer to about it,
yep.
I love that people are still told, if you come across it or you're walking through there, you're encouraged to throw a stone on it.
Yep, yep. Keep, gotta keep adding to stones, just to be careful, be sure. But again, I think that speaks to the level of belief, you know. Not everyone necessarily believes she's actually in there and could climb out, but you're still probably going to add a stone just to be sure.
Yeah. It doesn't, yeah. I mean, it's fine, you know. Who's it going to hurt if you add another stone to it, Morgan, regardless?
Yeah. Well, and better safe than sorry. So.
Always when you're dealing with vampires, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And speaking of vampires, as I touched on before we dove into the Duradoo, this other character who sounds very interesting in a variety of ways, because this is another one of these people that seems to be a multifaceted magical being,
yep.
that seems to be able to do 17 different things in so many different disciplines as well, but also has this kind of aspect to him that people don't sort of fear him as perhaps as much as they should do, which is the wonderfully entitled Albrecht. What can you tell us about this particular chap, because this is another very interesting and very dangerous character, it would seem.
Yeah, and he's a really fascinating one, the Artak, because we see him we see references to him, of course, in the folklore, but we see him sort of connected to Finn Michul, who is one of the sort of great epic Irish heroes, which would sort of anchor him like quite a ways back in belief. The word Artak itself, particularly in the older Irish, just means a dwarf, both in the sense of like a person who, you know, today we would call like a little person, someone who's, you know, under 5-4 feet tall as a human, but also a dwarf in the sense of a magical being who is shorter, but who has magical powers and is not necessarily human. And so when we kind of see him in the story, he is this sort of magical being who is connected to Finn and to the Fianna. And then in the later folklore, he is sort of described as this still magical being, but more literally like a magician, like a magic user, and someone who was sort of in charge of a particular area and who was a tyrant, who would just be gratuitously cruel to the people he was responsible for. And after, you know, going on like this for quite a while, and again, depending on the story, well, depends on how long he supposedly did these things. He was either killed by sort of a rival, or again, that connection to Finn McCool, he was killed, you know, by Finn. And he was buried, did not stay buried, came back, and in some versions, you know, was then drinking blood and doing the typical vampire things we might expect. It was killed again, still did not stay buried. Came back again, and again, in some versions of the story, it's going to depend on how many times he ends up getting killed before eventually they kill him the final time, theoretically, and this time they bury him head down, and they put a stone over the top of his grave. So again, kind of like the Duradoo, we see this idea of having to have some kind of weight on top so that he can't get back out again. But yeah, even today, there's folklore about him and the idea that, you know, even with the stone and even with that he can still come back or potentially is still around drinking blood and, you know, torturing people for fun, whatever it is he does on the weekend.
Well, he's one of those archetypal bad guys as well, as you say, Morgan. He keeps coming back. How many times are we supposed to kill him? And it is interesting that it is one of those things where you're thinking, well, I know enough about Irish mythology that if there's a vampire running about, you bury him under some stones. You know, what are these guys doing that it takes them 3 times to do it?
Yeah, that is kind of the standard approach, I think, in You know, every culture has their own "this is how you handle vampires." In Ireland, it is definitely bury them under a bunch of really heavy rocks. Oh, which reminds me, there is a really good movie that just came out called The Boys from County Hell. And it's set in Ireland. It's an all-Irish cast. And it basically is what happens when you accidentally take up the stone that is covering the grave of the Eartach, and then have a very unhappy, malicious Eartach after you. I haven't watched it yet, but I've heard really good things about it. So I'm trying to watch it as soon as I have a chance. For people who are looking for modern versions of the folklore, that's as modern as you get.
Yeah, and but he's it's another one as well where the site of his burial is supposed to be, I think it's in a town called Slachtevi, or Slachtivity.
Yeah, in Derry.
Yeah, where he's supposed to be buried. Now, this might be one of those sort of modern urban myths, Morgan, but apparently they tried to, I don't know why, they tried to remove this stone because, oddly enough as well, a hawthorn tree has grown near this alleged grave, which once again leads us into another set of creatures we perhaps need to keep on the right side of.
I would 100% not be touching that stone if it was me. Between the hawthorn tree and the stone, no. No.
Yeah. For me, looking at that, like I say, even with the little knowledge I have on this subject, Morgan, there are alarm bells ringing. As soon as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, what are these people trying to do?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not an interesting story if it doesn't start with humans doing something they shouldn't do. I think every good movie and or, you know, folklore story, even a lot of the mythology starts with someone doing something that's really not a good idea.
Yes, perhaps the scriptwriter of this particular new film has read that report and thought the same as we did, Morgan, and thought, what the bloody hell are they doing?
Yeah, well, and they decided to illustrate like this. What this is what will happen if you do this. It's not going to end well.
Yeah, let's stand back from our respective countries and just watch what happens, shall we say?
Yeah. I think you know, it's interesting the way that we can find folklore like that depicted in modern media. In things like movies, because that is so so similar to the stories, the oral stories. This idea of, you know, it's buried under a stone, you don't mess with the stone, or it's going to come back, and it's, you know, it likes to drink blood, and you definitely do not want to be part of that.
Very true, very true. It's interesting for me that there are these two really well-known kind of stories here that we're talking about vampires, which I think for a lot of people outside of a real understanding of Celtic mythology, Morgan, are going to be surprised to see that we do have these well-established vampire characters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we have those in Ireland. In Scotland, you have the Bavanshee, who are women. They tend to appear to small groups of hunters who are like out alone in the woods and sort of offer to keep them company to help entertain them. But they will end up drinking their blood, basically killing them, which is very traditionally vampiric. They're considered a fairies. They have the legs of deer in the stories, and you know, they can't be around iron, which is a fairy thing, but you know, the blood drinking is definitely pretty vampiric. And I think that surprises some people. You wouldn't expect that you would have that sort of crossover, first of all, between vampires and fairies, but also that idea of these sort of very explicitly vampiric beings in Scottish folklore either.
It is. I think it's quite strange living in England, I think, to see that we've got such well-established vampiric traditions in Irish and Scottish mythology. And yet here in England, we seem to have just completely ignored them. And it would be interesting, I suspect, if we had the ability, perhaps, Morgan, to see if there were some English stories that focused on these types of characters or these warnings of creatures to steer clear of that have simply just fallen out of favor.
I would suspect that there probably were stories. I mean, not necessarily literally, you know, blood drinking stories, but I would suspect there are at least very similar concepts and ideas in the stories. They just weren't preserved the same way, or they weren't moved forward the same way. You know, English fairy lore gets very complicated. it is still very complicated, to be fair, because you have a lot of, you know, regionally specific material. But then you also have a very, very old, I mean, I shouldn't say that, I make it sound like it's like a millennia, but, you know, back through Shakespeare's time of literary fairies, which you kind of create this layer over the top of the oral stories and the folklore, where then you have, you know, these other stories that are being told in a different way, but everything kind of interacts with everything else. You know, it's interesting to look at, you know, the idea of, for example, like tiny fairies, miniaturized fairies.
Yeah.
That definitely came from around Shakespeare's time, around that, you know, 16th, early 17th century, if I'm remembering my dates correctly, with sort of this wider cultural fascination, you know, with microscopes and science and the idea of atoms and things being very tiny.
Yeah.
So then we see this idea of fairies being very tiny, and we see it appearing in, you know, poetry, and, you know, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet has Queen Mab. And then the idea kind of diffuses from there. And we start to see that being a more widespread concept in English folklore. And things like that just fascinate me. The way you have that interplay between sort of the literary material and, you know, what people would be believing at home, I guess would say.
And I suppose it's often very interesting as well that you can kind of see when the sort of version of these myths and legends and stories sort of transcend the community and become literal, where they are written up, and the changes that occur, because obviously, as you touch on there, there are very different strands when it comes to the lore of the Fae, and it depends where you are, especially here in the UK, as you say, because I think often people, once again, Morgan, prescribe their personal version of the Fae to everyone's. So anybody who's read Shakespeare or things like Midsummer Night's Dream and the characters that are used there and other famous sort of fairies in literature throughout the centuries, I think often will then say, oh, well, that's what they are in Ireland, or that's what they are in Scotland, or that's what they are in Wales. Whereas really, they're not even that in Cornwall, never mind anywhere else.
Right. No, and that is 100% true. And, you know, I think everyone, it's human nature in a way. I know I do it. I try not to, because I know better theoretically, but I have a friend who's Welsh, and she writes quite a bit about this. She's working on a book on Welsh fairies, actually. And, you know, I've said some things to her where she'll be like, actually, that's not so much how it works over here. Because I was just assuming if that's how it is in Ireland, you know, then the Welsh fairies would be similar. And no, not always. You know, so you definitely have to sort of watch for that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of those strands of Celtic mythology, because obviously you have large and long histories in Ireland, Scotland and Wales, and large Celtic populations, Morgan, that often, you know, and I certainly don't mean this in regards to yourself, I think a lot of people tend to kind of think that all the Celts had exactly the same beliefs, but Ireland, Wales and Scotland clearly had very different definitions of what their mythologies meant.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I think again, this is just one of those really common things that people fall into, because there is a tendency to sort of refer to everything as Celtic. You know, Celtic mythology, Celtic folklore. Celtic, of course, just meaning Celtic language speaking cultures. But each of those cultures can be very, very different.
Yeah.
And how they have the material. Like Ireland and Scotland, in my experience, at least having studied both pretty extensively, are reasonably similar. But they also have a lot of cross-cultural influence with each other. But then you get into places like, you know, like you were just saying, Cornwall, Wales, even, you know, if we're talking like Devon, some of the particular areas, and the material can be very, very different. And just I shouldn't even say material, because that makes it sound very analytical, but the beliefs, the way that people approach different concepts, you know, things that you would absolutely not do in one area, in another place, like that's the thing you want to do. And in the same way, like a being that might be considered really dangerous in one place, like you wouldn't ever want to, for example, fairy hounds, I'll use that, in some places, like you would never want to go near them. There's Scottish stories with the Cushy where if you hear them howling, you need to get indoors right away because, you know, it's not a good thing. It's very dangerous. But there's other places in England. I'm trying to remember exactly which part of England, because that would be helpful in this conversation. But Mark Norman has a good book called Black Dogs, which talks about all sorts of folklore. Yeah. And there's very specific locations where they're actually seen as positive, like they'll show up to protect travelers in the woods. They'll show up to, you know, guide people who are lost. And that's completely different. It's 180 from, you know, some of the Scottish stories of the Cushy. So.
Yeah. Because we have that where I am in Yorkshire. Morgan,
okay.
Where you've got very different versions of the Shuck. Because we don't even call them shucks here in Yorkshire. We call them bar guests or padfoots.
Okay,
And different counties have that version where, for some people, it's a really bad omen. And for others, they are seen as the protector of lonely travellers. And that can be seen all over the UK in certain aspects, because the shuck legend, even if you look at that one facet of it here in England, if you go around the country, they are all similar, but they all have very different little facets and nuances that you can't, once again, prescribe your belief of how they act in, even in a county, to the next door, because often they don't match.
Right. It's just everyone has their own stories and their own beliefs around it. You know, it's the same thing in Ireland. If we talk about the Cushy, they're very particular. They guard the old forts. They guard the Shí.
Mm.
So, you know, supposedly the places where there's treasure left by the good folk, which is very different from what we find, like you're saying, in England or Scotland or any of that. So, you know, even in Ireland, if you go in one particular area, you might find stories that have a more malicious tone to a particular creature, like, say, the Pooka, because Pooka is found all over Ireland. But, you know, in some places, it's much more malicious. Like, you would not want to run into them. They will trick you into riding them and then basically torment you until the sun rises, like, horrifically, very, very bad. But then in other places, you know, if you go to a different a county, a different area, they're just sort of not exactly benevolent, but they're just sort of tricksters. You know, they'll trick you, but usually it's no harm comes to anyone. They can even be helpful under certain circumstances. Again, when it comes to travelers, sometimes they'll do more protective things. But it's, you know, the difference of 200 miles even can be profound with some of these stories.
And I think that kind of leads us to your next book that's due out in the summer that you're currently working on, which is about the Ishi and meeting the fair folk. And I know, when looking at what you're trying to cover in this book, this is dealing with the misunderstandings and misconceptions that people perhaps put all fairy folk and the fae into one box, Morgan, and said, right, well, whatever applies here applies everywhere. And clearly as we've just been covering there, that's simply not the case. So is that one of the sort of driving forces behind this new book?
Yep. I have Pagan Portals Eishi comes out August, I believe, next year. And sort of the two main things that got me to want to write it, like you just said, the fact that there's a lot of confusion about, particularly even with the Irish, although it's massively popular, there's a lot of stuff that you'll find floating around online or, you know, in some books that is, we'll just say not exactly Irish. It's a little more creative, modern interpretation of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I had wanted to put something out there that was looking more at what we actually have for the Irish folklore, what we actually do know. And then the other thing is I've always been really inspired by the quote of, if there's a book out there that you want to read and it doesn't exist, you have to write it.
Yeah.
And this is something that I've looked for a long time, a book that is focused just on the Irish fairies, the Irish good folk. I'm hopeful that the market will now be flooded with them and there'll be many, many options. I know a couple people, Dr. Jenny Butler in Cork is working on one. I'm excited for that. Mm-hmm. Laura O'Brien just had something come out. So there cannot be enough of this, because right now there's just not anything. You know, you can find a few older folklore works, like Douglas Tides, By the Fire. Eddie Lanahan has a book, Meeting the Other Crowd, but it's all like stories, retelling stories. Patricia Lysat has a book on the Banshee, but it's just about the Banshee, not about anything else. So to have something out there that's kind of looking at these beliefs sort of across the range of them, and just focusing on the Irish material, I thought was something that would be really helpful for people and was important to have out there. And like I said, hopefully now the market will be flooded and there will be a lot of them.
Is it something, when you've been doing your research in this particular field then, Morgan, when you're looking at pulling this book together, that even when you're looking at the counties of Ireland, there are variations in how they treat the fae and the fair folk and how they react with the normal people that live around them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a little frustrating. And I've often joked that, like, the first rule when it comes to fairies is that there's an exception to every rule.
Yes.
you know, if you go to one area, for example, there might, you might be told, like, you never bring hawthorn inside.
Hmm.
Not all hawthorn, of course, are fairy trees. Like, they use them in hedgerows and they'll grow in other places. But it's just this belief you don't ever bring them inside. And then there's other places where, you know, at certain times of year, like, you know, May 1st, you might bring them inside. That's considered perfectly fine. There's certain areas where dirty water, if you have like dirty standing water in the house, that's thought to protect against fairies. They won't come in if you have that. And then you can, again, like I said, go, you know, a few counties over, or, you know, a different province, and all of a sudden it's the exact opposite. If you have dirty water standing in your house, that allows the fairies to come in. So that's it's a fascinating range of beliefs, but there's definitely a lot of variety with some of it.
Is it something that doesn't fail to surprise you, Morgan? I think as we touch on often, it's easy to kind of fall into that trap of prescribing the same rules to the same kind of phenomenon that you talk about, or the same kind of mythology that we look into. And I find that very interesting, because I've recently spoken with a lady called Icy Sedgwick who deals with British folklore. And Icy was, obviously, we were talking about things like yew trees, and the same kind of things that certain areas you would never bring the yew in because of its toxicity. Whereas in other areas, they bring it inside at Christmas or May Day and things like that, once again, as you would do with hawthorn.
Yep.
And we were kind of chewing over the fact that, is this kind of thing where people go visit relatives or friends in a different place and just don't listen to the rules and then come back and give and create their own version of these particular rules that you're supposed to follow?
You know, it's an interesting thought. I don't know if it's that the different area, just the beliefs have kind of gone in a different direction, or if, like you said, it was a misunderstanding that then got perpetuated and sort of solidified into folk belief in a different place. You know, we have many things that are sort of universal, if you will. The idea that iron is a protection against the good folk, dairy products as an offering, milk, cream, butter, you know, but yet then we do have these other particular things that can be very, very different in different locations. So I think I'm constantly surprised by the new things that are out there that I learn, and the layers to a lot of it. You know, sort of just when you think you've kind of gotten a handle on how something is understood or what people believe about something, and then you'll find out something new. Actually, just had this happen. I had run across something that had said Finvarra, who is a king of the fairies in Galway.
Mm-hmm.
And I was aware he's a king of the fairies in Galway. He's actually one of the Tuatha Dé Danann. He's the Dagda's youngest son. This is from mythology. And he's one of the more well-known fairy kings in Ireland. He's mentioned across a lot of folklore. But I had run across something that referenced him as the High King of all the fairies of Ireland, which I'd never seen before.
Mm.
So I was a little skeptical because there is a lot of misinformation out there. And I was asking around, and I had a couple friends in that area, and they were like, no, that's actually a common thing that storytellers in Galway say.
Mm.
So, which I thought was amusing for several reasons, including the fact that I'm pretty sure the rest of Ireland might disagree about, you know, him being the High King of all the Irish fairies. But it was kind of fascinating to learn that wasn't something that was coming from sort of outside pop culture, but it was something that, you know, people in Galway do believe or do say sometimes, even though other parts of Ireland clearly have different opinions.
I suppose that's probably one of the most addictive qualities of this subject, Morgan, is the fact that every time, like you say, you think you've got a handle on it, or you think you've gone, right, well, I've got this covered now, and I know what this refers to, and I know why everybody likes Hawthorne or certain mounds. And then I suppose the more you look into it, the more contradictions you'll stumble across.
I honestly think one of the reasons that I still love this subject as much as I do, after studying it for a lot longer than I want to publicly admit, is that you are always learning something new. You know, it's like a bottomless pit in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can never get to a point where you know everything about it and there's nothing else to learn. And I love that. You know, it's no matter how much you think you know, there's always a story you haven't heard. There's always a town whose folklore you're not familiar with that has a different view of something.
Hmm.
And it just keeps you going.
Yeah. Is there an aspect of this subject you've yet to really kind of tackle, or is there some one part of it that you're really sort of looking down the line to think, that's what I'd really kind of like to take on as my next challenge in regards to this fascinating subject?
The Irish folklore is really my passion. I love that. I would love an opportunity to learn more of the regionally specific material. I'm most familiar with like the Southwest when it comes to the folklore, and then the sort of Midlands in a more general way. And then obviously the more widespread Irish folklore. As you mentioned earlier when you had talked about the YouTube, I am currently doing a series on the Scottish ballads, so I'm a little sucked into that at the moment. It's fascinating to look at the amount of belief that is in the ballads. You know, because they're created obviously for entertainment, but it's entertainment based on the inclusion of these ideas that everyone would have understood at the time, you know, and some things today we do still understand, and other references you just kind of have to try to figure out. And I love a puzzle, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it's very interesting when you're going into there with this knowledge base that you have, and then you're dealing with somewhere so close, and yet it's intrinsically so far away when you look at trying to sort of unpick it all and try and clarify what the hell does this all mean then.
Yes. And I definitely have to watch myself for what we were just talking about with that bias and not assume and try to, you know, make sure that I'm taking the material for what it is and not sort of projecting onto it. That's a constant thing you have to guard against. But yeah, it's just a fascinating subject. And there's so much more out there. You know, as we've established, I have a basic knowledge of Welsh fairy lore. I was just able to take a very interesting class on Cornish fairy lore. And, you know, I'm trying to sort of expand outwards, but there's so much more to all of that. I could easily spend another 20 years and probably still not know a half of what's out there.
Yeah. I must admit, Morgan, since I've started doing this show, my very limited knowledge of folklore in general, regardless of the Fae or the legends and myths of Scotland and Wales and Ireland. Besides, I've learned so much in 3 years, and I know I've barely scratched the surface. Is it something that sometimes, as you refer to there, when people talk about fairies, I would suspect that, as you've just touched on there, most people wouldn't even think that Wales would have a tradition or a differential aspect to this whole subject.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the thing, is that a lot of people default to that sort of general fairy lore, or, you know, quite frankly, a lot of people just assume the Irish is sort of everything.
Yes.
Everything is that, you know, and it's interesting to look and to see the similarities and the differences. I'm excited for my friend's book on the Welsh fairies. Mara Starling is my friend who's working on this, because there really isn't a lot on the Welsh material either, unless you speak Welsh, which unfortunately I speak Welsh at like a toddler level, which is not helpful.
Yeah, it's ahead of mine.
Probably not by much. You know, but what we have for the Welsh material, for the most part, is, you know, again, these books that came out 100 years ago, which you kind of have to be cautious when you read, just because there's a lot of questionable material, we'll say. But, you know, there's just not, it's not a subject a lot of people, at least so far, have really written about. Cornish, at least, there are some good books out there.
Yeah.
You just have to get them. But Welsh, there definitely needs to be more. Definitely needs more. And of course, you know, one of the other big challenges of folklore in general with all of this is that it's always changing. It adapts and it grows and it evolves with the culture. So, you know, for example, one of my favorite Welsh stories that I do know about pixies, involves a midwife. It's a bard midwife story, which is sort of the bard midwife is a motif we find across all of fairy lore. It's very common and popular, but
yeah.
This one talks about a midwife who's borrowed, in order to help with this fairy birth, this pixie birth, but she travels on a bus.
Yes.
To get where she needs to go. But to me, that's such a beautiful example of the way the beliefs survive. You know, it's not stuck 100, 200 years ago. It's not this sort of archaic thing. It's very much sort of fluid and adaptable. And also the idea of pixies taking a bus just entertains me. But, you know, and that's another aspect of there's always more to learn, because there's always new stories, new anecdotes, new material.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm fortunate enough, my family used to holiday in Wales quite a lot. So I know the difference between the Welsh, only on a basic level. And it's very interesting that it's only sort of in the last 10 years I've kind of seen it come back into its kind of own, Morgan, because I remember being a lad, and you'd go in the tourist shops and they'd have the little Welsh pixies you could take. And I used to say to my grandmother and my grandfather, oh, are they fairies? And they'd say, oh, no, they're pixies. They're different.
Yeah.
They're the Welsh ones. And I was like, oh. And they dress differently. They wear their bright little red jackets and their little black hats.
Yep.
So it is interesting how, as you say, that we can sometimes just try and mash everything together. And nowadays, I think there is such an appetite and a thirst for this subject that we're able to pull them back out again and give them their individuality back, I suspect.
Yes, which I think is a wonderful thing. Mm. I'm really thrilled to see it. Of course, it causes massive confusion as people try to like understand. Yeah. As we move from sort of the general to the specific. But yeah, I think it's wonderful to start seeing things being appreciated, like you were saying, that previously would have been sort of just mashed together. Well, even what you were saying before with like the Barghest versus like Shuck versus some of the other black dogs that are out there, you know, there was a point when those all just would have been sort of lumped together. And it's nice to see the strands of the stories and the folklore being pulled apart and appreciated individually.
Very true. Very true. And I think, Morgan, that's a perfect point to let you return to the world of reality. So, thank you
such
again.
Such as it is.
Well, such as we can hope.
Yeah.
Firstly, thank you again for coming back. It's always a wonderful conversation with you. I learn so much, and you're always so very kind and gracious with your knowledge and your education of me as a host. Where can everybody keep up to date and follow your marvellous YouTube channel and get hold of a copy of some of your wonderful books, Morgan?
Oh, thank you very much for having me on again. It was delightful. My YouTube is under Morgan Daimler. I try to keep everything on social media under the name that I write under just because it's convenient. It makes me easy to find.
Yes.
Amazon has my books. Brick and mortar stores, I do encourage people to kind of go in if you can to a physical store. I realize with COVID that's not always possible, but if they don't have them, they can usually order them. Otherwise, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, online sources like that. I write for John Hunt Publishing, Moon Books, which is through John Hunt Publishing. So you can also go on their website, and they have links for where to order my books from. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm everywhere, sadly. But yeah, all under Morgan Daimler, so I'm fairly easy to find.
Fabulous. Well, thank you again, Morgan. And I also wanted to just congratulate you on one of your books. It looks like it's being translated into French.
Yes, I'm very excited. Speaking of Pagan Portals, Lou, that's one of the ones that's going to be coming out in French soon. So we can spread the joy of Lou to France.
Fantastic. Well, all power to you, Morgan. And once again, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. And hopefully we will speak again sooner rather than later.
Thank you very much for having me on.